Welcome to episode 9 of the Brief Encounter podcast with me, Johnny Boyle. On this particular episode, I was talking to Rick McMurray, the drummer from Northern Irish band Ash. Rick was very kind to spend some time with me and answer a lot of questions that I had. I think this particular podcast, I probably talk a little bit too much, more than usual, as we share a lot of tour stories and I probably reveal a little bit too much about myself. So, if you felt like I talk too much, maybe you can bang me off a message on my Instagram page. On this episode, we talk about how the band got together. It was a pre-COVID conversation and the band was due to go on a very extensive tour. Rick talks about, you know, getting their very first demo into the right hands and how quickly they had success, particularly in the UK, around the Britpop era. Rick talks about Charlotte Hatherley joining the band, and we have a bit of a drummer chat, talking about drummers we like and our experiences recording in Rockfield Studios in Wales. And Rick also shares with me information that they had a song in a Jackie Chan movie, Rumble in the Bronx, which I think is pretty cool. So I hope you like this chat, folks, and hope everybody's staying safe out there, and I hope we can all get back gigging soon. So take care and talk to you soon. Bye.
Therapy days.
Just kicking around, following him on Instagram and whoever he's playing with as well. So
It's amazing how up to date we can all keep with each other without actually meeting. You meet people now and you've nothing to talk about because everyone knows what you're up to.
Exactly.
So what are you up to? New record? Is it a collection of singles?
I don't know what you call it. It's kind of like it's been sort of like loosely tagged around our 25th anniversary, which was, I guess it's the 25th anniversary of Girl from Mars coming out, because obviously it didn't get it together in time to do the official anniversary, but that's what it's tagged around. So it's like a best of, like a new record company, BMG, who's weirdly enough the old record company at the same time, because it's Corda Marshall, who originally signed us back in like 94. He's the MD at BMG now, and he's bought all the back catalogue, so it's like kind of like getting the old team back together almost.
So have you guys been on a kind of hiatus, or?
No, not really. I mean, we've sort of not been as busy as we were, as myself and Mark. We've got kids, stuff like that. I think it's sort of like after we did the A to Z series, which was like putting out a single every 2 weeks, which we did sort of like we did for a year. It was like in 2009, 2010. Sort of post that, Tim did a solo album, which sort of, there was like a few kind of like him getting deal. There was like sort of like verbal agreements for him putting the record out, which fell through, and then that sort of like bumped things back. So it was quite a bit of a break then, but we've always done sort of festivals during the summer regardless of what else is going on, so we've not really sort of like had a massive break.
Sure. And how many singles are on this record?
Depends on the format.
I saw the vinyl package.
The vinyl's like, I think it's about 21 songs in the vinyl.
Really?
And the CDs, I don't know. I haven't added it up yet.
How many on the A to Z series, how many singles did you actually put out?
I was like 26.
You actually did 26?
One every 2 weeks for a year,
Because I always kind of saw you as a kind of a singles band.
We've had that reputation, I think.
Yeah, I mean, why, I wonder?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know, it's a weird thing we always find at festivals when we play there. We go out front and there's people like, oh yeah, I saw you. And it's like, completely forgot it was you that did that song. I love that song. It's like, there's something to do with this weird kind of thing where people like love the song, don't necessarily identify it with the band very strongly. So it's like, when they see us live, they're like, oh wow, that's, you know, it's like, and obviously live we're playing, you know, it's all the hits. We've never shied away from that, like a Radiohead, like not wanting to play Creep or anything like that.
Sure. That's mad, because I remember meeting Tim. I just joined the Frames, I think it was like 2003, and I was only in them like a wet week, and I think I was doing one of my first shows in the Olympia, and thank you. And yeah, I was doing one of my first shows in the Olympia, and you know, three gigs in, I was getting to play Shining Light with Tim, which was great.
Oh,
he's a nice dude, amazingly talented guy, you know.
Yeah.
But when you guys kind of emerged with Girl from Mars, I was living in Derry actually. I was living in Derry, and I was working as a DJ, so I was kind of playing a lot of that stuff, you know. Because I mean, back then you had that kind of Britpop explosion. I know you, but I never saw you guys as part. You guys were a rock and roll band.
Yeah, it was a weird thing. It's obviously, you know, with producers we chose to work with, Owen Morris, who's obviously very strongly identified with like Oasis and the Verve and stuff. That was like sort of like almost like having one toe in that sort of world, but obviously coming from Northern Ireland and having the, you know, having a musical kind of phenomenon like dub as a Brit,
yeah,
thing was like something that didn't sit sort of very comfortably with our kind of roots, you know.
Sure.
And musically as well. I mean, we were, you know, we got together in '92, and that was like, you know, it was Nirvana were the thing that kind of turn things around, sort of like from being like, you know, metal kids,
yeah,
and but not knowing how to play, to going like, well, these guys don't really know how to play either, so I guess we can do this.
Yeah, because I mean, were you guys an Iron Maiden covers band or something like that?
that was the other guys.
that was the other guys.
Well, that was the thing. They never did covers because basically no one had figured out how to play like all this like technical metal stuff, so it was just kind of like very much, it was like, we're going to start a band. They got guitars for Christmas and then started to learn how to play.
And with the other guys then, was it did you make the conscious decision to pick up the kit, or was it I'll get a guitar and I'll get a set of drums, or
well, Tim and Mark had been playing together for like a couple of years before I ended up joining.
Yeah,
and I met Tim at school play of all things, which was called The Suicide, where I was playing a drunken detective, and he was like this itinerant like gypsy musician, and he's in the dressing room, sort of picked up his guitar, so could you mind if I would go, and he was like, oh yeah, I'm getting together with a few friends, we're gonna like just have a jam, play a few covers like over the summer holidays, yeah, or Easter holidays or whatever it was, and I was like, well, I play drums. He was, oh, cool. Well, you know, so we haven't got a drummer yet, so yeah, bring your kid along.
Brilliant.
We did that, and then he sort of like phoned me again, said, we're having another rehearsal, but it turned up and it was just him and Mark, and no cover versions we've seen. It was just working on
just the original
material,
stuff.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
I know Bono says the same thing. He says, you too. He says, we're shit at covers. We can't play covers. You know, that's just, he says, we're not good enough musicians. He said, you know.
Well, I don't know. I've heard them do a few.
They've done a few.
the odd one.
And what drew you to the drums initially? What age were you?
I think it was probably about 13. I actually started playing guitar first. I think I got a guitar when I was like probably 10 or 11, started getting into guitar. But I don't know, I think it was just I was listening to music one day, and it's just like the drums were just suddenly like going on, and started just sort of tapping along. I was like, oh, I can kind of do that.
Yeah.
And it just sort of expired, and then it was like, well, no one else I know is a drummer. It's like, you know, like everyone else I knew played guitar. I was like, well, if we're gonna have a band, someone's gonna play drums. I was like, yeah,
that's cool.
I can do that. Yeah.
That's that kind of similar thing happened to myself. I mean, Abbey Road and Dark Side of the Moon were on constant rotation in my house. We only had about 8 vinyls anyway.
So you had a good choice.
You know, so my old man played guitar and piano, and he sang, and he was a bit of a raconteur, but it was the same for me, just listening to those records, hearing Ringo, hearing Nick Mason's playing. I was just drawn to the sound of all of that, you know what I mean? Similar kind of thing. I was 12 years of age, and you know, went to a Hoover shop one day to buy a spare part, and there was a drum kit in the window, you know. Of course, pleaded with my old man to get it, you know what I mean? But as soon as I got that, I just knew exactly what I wanted to be. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And thankfully, I've still been able to get away with it.
Yeah, exactly. That's a big part of it, getting away with it.
But you guys were really young. Like, I mean, how old were you when the first single came out? Just like 17 or something?
Yeah, I mean, when the other guys were like, when we get signed, I think they were just 17. I'm like sort of a little bit older. I was like a year above them in school, so
yeah.
I was born 75.
Right.
So like the album title kind of shaves a couple off for me, which is good.
Ah, right. Okay. So they were born in 77, were
yeah,
they?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Because I remember at the time, 77 also, was there, you guys are big Star Wars fans.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Are you still a Star Wars fan?
Mark is, yeah.
Mark is, is he?
Yeah, I don't know. I've been to see every movie.
Yeah.
Whether I've enjoyed them or not is another question. But
yeah, yeah, I hear yeah. you. You know, it's mad you see people on the internet. It's like Star Wars has ruined their life, you know. And it's all you got to do is remind yourself that the original trilogy will always be there for you. That's
exactly.
all you need.
It's like, yeah, it's like, I think there's a lot of people out there, like, talking themselves into liking the new stuff.
Yeah.
Because otherwise their life will be ruined.
Yeah. It's just a movie.
Yeah.
Just a movie. So, I suppose you guys were up on... I mean, after playing for a few years, you're signed. You know, the singles come out. How did you adapt to all of that, being quite young, you know? Because even talking to Graham, like, Graham Hopkins was out, and he was out, like, 16 years of age, just out in L.A., living in a house, hanging out with Guns N' Roses and Alice in Chains, and, you know, I think they spent something like $5 million on that band and made two records that they never released, you know, which is insane, you know? But how... Because, I mean, you know, kind of... I mean, I hate to say it happened overnight for you, but it did kind of...
Yeah, it did happen. Did happen quickly. But, yeah, I guess our experience is quite different from Graham's. It was very much... We got a demo tip into the right hands to begin with. Yeah. And we got, like, a single put out. Weirdly enough, we'd actually had a bit of interest... I can't remember the name of the label, but it was I remember the band was Daisy Chainsaw.
Oh yeah, I remember them.
And their label was kind of they got hold of a tape, and they were in touch with Tim for a little while.
Yeah.
And then suddenly went cold. So we were like, you know, we were like 16, going like, oh man, how do we get out? We're never going to get a record deal. What are we going to do? Kind of thing. But then obviously a tape, you know, we had the ambition, but we never really had the I don't know, we were sort of naive, just like wondering why it didn't happen. We didn't know what to do.
Yeah, yeah.
But luckily a tape got in the right hands, and this guy who had his own, sorry, he was his own label, was just putting out one-off singles, agreed to put out Jack Names the Planets. I mean, he put that out, and off the back of that, we were like, we really need a manager because we don't know what we're doing.
Yeah,
I kind of talked him into becoming our manager, and then from that, that's when things just happened super fast.
Right. Okay.
At that point, yeah.
Okay. That's first record, second record. Was it by the third record? Was a bit of fatigue starting to show.
Yeah. Yeah. Bit? I mean, I guess like the first record, which was like.
So yeah.
Manager.
Oh, is that your manager?
Just sitting over there, yeah.
Oh, cool. I'm sure the fun out of doing promo, I'm sure that evaporated.
Well, I was just surprising her there. She was like, I thought that was you talking around the corner. It's like, yeah, it's like, don't worry, I'm arranging my own press.
Because I remember having to do promo. I mean, you know, back in the day when I was touring a lot, you'd get up in the morning, you'd do a radio show, and then in the afternoon you'd do an in-store, and then you'd do a gig that night.
Yeah. I honestly don't know how we did it back then.
Yeah. Well, when you're young, you're pretty invincible. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
I was pretty fucking wild. I mean, I wasn't sleeping very much. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
You know,
I can barely handle a 6:30. So I was 6:30 this morning, getting up to get over here. We're like, but normally up at that time anyway. But
yeah.
Just when you text there, I'm just like lying in bed. I can do with a nap.
Oh, listen, the daytime nap. Once you get over 40, the daytime nap is essential, you know? I mean, you got your kids are still quite young, aren't they?
8 and 5.
Okay, so you're still in the thick of it. I mean, I've got my eldest girl is she's got like a year and a half of school left. She's 17.
Right,
bloody. And I have a 13-year-old, you know. And so it's like, you know, it was great when I got to that point where I didn't have to get babysitters anymore. I could just go out.
Yeah.
And I could leave them on their own. You know what I mean? And there's a certain freedom in that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, probably need to stop going to the pub as much as I do, but I'm catching up on all the years I didn't go, you know.
Well, I'm in the middle of that. I don't remember how to go out. Hence the 0-0.
Yeah, geez. Well, a good night out's a quiet night in, as they say.
Exactly.
I'm skipping ahead from the first record to the third record because, you know, I certainly found from touring and it was on a different scale, obviously, to your scale. It was a much, much higher level than what you were doing, you know. I mean, I loved it, but definitely after 12 years of doing it, I was ready for a break.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't take a break consciously. It was my gig with the Frames ended because Glenn won his Oscar.
Yeah.
And then he was going to go on tour with Marquette. And that, you know, so I was a little bit disappointed that, but a little bit disappointed that that gig was gone. But I was supposed to play with that band for 2 weeks and I spent 4 years with them. So I think I did.
Yeah.
I think I did all right, you know. Like, so it was good. And they're doing their 30th anniversary in June. So
oh, no way.
I'm going to hopefully see them all, you know, because I missed the 25th anniversary. Yeah. So I'm not going to miss this one. But anyway, yeah, so I suppose, was there a certain turning point with you guys by the third record? Because, I mean, the three records, they came out pretty, like, it's probably tour album.
Yeah, it was full on. I think the turning point was almost, like, around the time 1977 went to number one. I think our expectation of what that meant was, like, oh, great, we've made it. Whereas everyone else's expectation was, like, well, here's where the hard work starts. And we didn't really get our heads around that, and it was suddenly, you know, it was the sort of, like, you know, partying all night, getting up for interviews, doing the gig, and just on that kind of thing for over a year, and just, you know, just going, like, there's a few points we're going, like, we're just not enjoying this. Why are we not enjoying it?
Yeah,
it's just like we should be. It's like, you know, it's your dream come true. Like, but what's going on? But so it was a bit weird.
yeah. I mean, you know, drinking's one thing. I think when drugs come into the picture, that steps everything up onto a whole other level. You know, you're certainly staying up later and stuff like that. And, you know, I mean, I don't know to what extent how crazy you guys went. I know my own experiences were pretty full on, but it was like anything, you know. I just got up one day and went, right, that was a bit of fun, and just got on my life then and stopped doing all that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's more difficult for other people, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. Drugs were never a big part of what we did.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think being that young, I guess we probably didn't need the drugs to drink all night.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then work all day.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just, you know, got into this cycle of, you know, of boozing just like all the time.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, you look back on it, but that was probably, you know, it was kind of coping mechanism as well, you know. But I think, I mean, that was one turning point. I think the next was when the follow-up album came out. It did all right, but it didn't do what the last one did. And so that was the first time for us, because it felt like everything we did had grown and grown and grown, like right up to having the number one album. And then suddenly it was like, you know, if this record had come out before that, it would have been, you know, part of this climb up.
Yeah.
But it was just like, we were like, oh, right, well, no one's that interested anymore. It's kind of like, and that was around the time like the Britpop bubble had burst as well. So all our kind of contemporaries were like getting dropped, you know, or not getting their album released or whatever. So it was a bit of a weird time. But, you know, I think we had because, you know, as I said, it only felt like we had like a toe in the Britpop kind of thing, that we felt, you know, we can kind of like sidestep this. And, you know, I think we're having Youth on our side as well. I think we had still had the belief that we had another great album in us. And, you know, it was like we were like seeing all this stuff happen to every other band we knew. I was going like, that's not going to be us. And if it is, we're going to make sure that we go out on the best album we can possibly make. So,
yeah. I mean, you guys are 25 years, a long time to play with the same dudes as well. Like, you know, I've played with some people now for 25, 30 years, you know, and you you fall out, you make up again, you fall out again, you leave, you join. I've kind of had that revolving door relationship with Picture House over the years, you know.
Yeah.
So around that time then, Tim went to New York, didn't he, for like a while? Or did you all move to New York? Or?
Tim and Mark both moved, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, this was like probably, it was a good few years after, sort of, after, it was probably 2005, 2006, something like that.
Okay.
So we'd sort of like got over our our crises.
Sure.
At that point.
And so when did Charlotte Hatterley join the band? Was that on?
She joined actually around Nuclear Sounds, which was the follow up to 1977. Okay. So that was another kind of like weird kind of like, she's joining this, like Tim had Writer's Block at the time as well, and we just got this new member in the band. It was like a real, it was a difficult album to make, but it was probably quite a weird thing for Charlotte to kind of walk in on, but
yeah. And she was there for what, 3-4 albums maybe, till about what, 2000, and
she was there for 3 albums.
2006,
so it was like 97 she joined. So it was 9 years.
It's a long time.
Big stretch, yeah.
It's a long time. And was it an amicable split? Did she just want to do her own thing, or?
Yeah, I mean, she was doing her own thing anyway.
Yeah.
She was always a great writer, but she'd got like a different management from us as well, and I think she got a new manager in, and that made things quite difficult.
Okay.
What the manager sort of expected for her client and what was realistic, where he just wasn't going to meet. And it was more that than anything else. It was never a personal thing, you know.
Yeah. That's funny, because, you know, so Tim essentially is the main writer in the band. Have you written any tunes in the band, or co-written, or?
Couple here and there. Yeah, not much.
Because I remember I read Keith Moon's book a couple of years ago, Dear Boy, it's called. And, you know, kind of, the vibe I got from that book was really what killed him was just having loads of time off.
Yeah.
You know, because you know, the lads had head off to, Pete Townsend had head off for like a year to write the record, and he'd just be left in LA driving cars into swimming pools and waking up to with a bottle of Courvoisier.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think if he'd been on tour like the whole time, he'd probably be all right.
He probably would have been all right, you know. Do you find downtime, how was downtime for you in between records and stuff like that? Would you keep yourself occupied?
Yeah, I have to find ways. I mean, I went through a long period of just being in drum room at home. I'd just like, you know, get the kids to school or whatever. I'd be in the drum room and I'd be like, God, I hadn't picked up the kids. What have I done with my day? I've just drummed.
That sounds like the ideal life to me.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah, so that's, you know.
That's the one thing that I don't have a drum room. That's the one thing that kills me is when you're renting.
Well, I mean, it's a drum room. It's our garage, which was converted into like extension before we moved in, and I've got like mesh heads and got silent cymbals on it, so it's not.
Okay, so you're not going full whack.
It's not. Yeah.
I have a set of V drums there, which I teach kids on, but I have to say I'm not a huge fan of playing them for long periods of time. You know.
No, I remember when I got my first set. It was just like, oh wow, this is, you know, because I'd had a. In previous house, I had this room and I had an acoustic kit in it. It was like 10 minutes. I was like, oh my God, I'm so deaf. I can't play acoustic drums in this room. So I've got a set of V drums. And I was just like, oh, this is great. And then going on to the kit.
Like, it's completely different, isn't it?
And it was just like, oh, why is that drum all the way over there? You know, it's like your rack tom feels like it's about 2 feet away from me or whatever. Yeah. So, and with the bounce of the mesh heads and stuff, but still got the mesh head problem, but I've been working my way around it.
Yeah. I kind of fall in and out of practicing, you know, that kind of way. I'm sure when you're touring, you're just playing and that's it. And, you know, but I suppose I go through phases where the certain part, like the summertime when I'm not in college, I'll use the college room because I can go in there and use it, you know. It's a little bit different when you're renting a room somewhere and you have to drive into the city and, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm just older and less motivated.
I think I'm getting to that point as well. It's sort of like after spending so much time doing it, it's just like, I'm learning this stuff. Am I actually going to use it?
Yeah.
Or I'm not learning it to a good enough level to be able to use it maybe, but I don't know. At the minute, I'm sort of like trying to, like, if I'm going to get in the kit, it's more like working with click tracks and like doing like the Benny Greb thing and like playing off the, like having the click off the downbeat.
I got you.
You know, and trying stuff like that, and just trying to feel a bit groovier, because you know that's kind of what it's all about, and that's what you should be focusing on.
I think, you know, there's an argument for some drummers kind of go on YouTube and they want to run before they learn how to walk, you know, and they will spend hours learning some drum fill.
I've been guilty of that as well.
It's fun to do, but the problem is you learn these drum fills that like basically take up a lot of time to learn, and if you played them with a band you'd probably get fired. You know, somebody should have a YouTube channel saying, you know, fills that get you fired. But I'm like yourself, I practice a lot of just practical stuff that's just backbeat orientated and whatnot, you know. I'm not a huge fill guy, I never really was, you know. It's more about just trying to, as you say, just have a good sense of time and groove. Do you use clicks live?
Yeah, we have. We've done, especially since we've gone back to the three piece after Charlotte as well. I think at that point we'd you know, going back to the three piece, we felt we'd fill out the sound with like different instrumentation, and then it was just basically me playing the click and having that on tape live.
Right. Okay.
So yeah, I'm pretty comfortable with that. But I think we went through a phase where it was just like, oh yeah, it'd be great to have everything in click. And now we're just like, if we need it. We'll do it. If we don't, it's kind of fun to not need to do it as well, you know.
Yeah, it can be a bit of a safety blanket. I play a lot of clicks and stuff like that. I did a record with a guy recently over in Rockfield, over in Wales.
Oh yeah,
did you ever do any records?
Yeah, well that's where we recorded 1977 and Nuclear Sounds as well. Yeah,
really?
So we've been in there.
That's
a bunch of times. Great.
That was a real dream come true for me. I know so many great records, like your own albums have been done there, and a couple of Oasis albums, and you know the first Queen record. And I mean, the place is steeped in history, and Kingsley.
Oh, Kingsley
has all the stories.
Yeah,
all the stories. I heard it's up for sale.
Somebody
said that to me. Now I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's sort of had its ups and downs over the years since we were there. I think it did come close to closing at one point, I'd heard, but
I think now they're doing Airbnb, so in some of the houses people can just rent the houses and come for the weekend, you know. That's where Noel Gallagher hit Liam with the cricket bat, wasn't it? They were recording. It's in the documentary. Because he kept going down to the boozer and bringing people back to kind of hear the mixes, and you know, and Noel was getting a pain in his ass with this. He came back one night and Noel smacked him across the head with a cricket bat, and apparently he gave him some clatter, you know.
But
apparently Kingsley told me a story where Liam was pissed off at Noel one day, so he saw Liam playing this guitar, so like they were having a round, he just picked up the guitar and he smashed it, and I was like, what the fuck are you doing? He says, that's the engineer's guitar, you know. And it was only worth a couple of hundred quid, but I think Liam went out and he spent about $2,000 on an acoustic for the engineer, and actually gave it to him, you know what I mean?
I probably know who that is as well. Yeah.
But I was over there doing, I was working with a guy called John Murray from Mississippi, really interesting songwriter, and John Parrish is producing a record from PJ Harvey, and he was just, I mean, he's a multi-instrumentalist, amazing guy to work with.
I think he worked in the Charlotte did stuff with him for a bit as well.
He's a great, really great guy to work with, and I'm going over to see him actually next week in Abbey Road. I've never been to Abbey Road, so all these things are I'm getting to do now in my 40s. I should have been doing this in my 20s, you know. So I was going to ask you, so in terms of, because when you guys started out, you know, it was that whole thing of getting in the van, getting on the road, playing gigs. This is pre-internet as well. So I did read somewhere that at one point you guys nearly went bankrupt.
Yeah, I mean, that was after the second record, and we'd we were pretty close to the wire. It was like, because we were working on the follow up, and we had a bunch of stuff that we were like really happy with. But I remember we met Joe Strummer at Fuji Rock in Japan, and he was like, "Oh, I'm playing Belfast. You guys should get up and do I Fought the Law with me." I was like, "Yeah, great." Tim was home at the time. He'd gone back home to do a lot of writing. And he called me. He was just like, "Yeah, I'm not going to make it, because I'm working on this song, so I don't want to. You know, while it's going good,
sure,
I just want to get this done." It was like, "Yeah, okay, fine. I went and watched the gig, and then the next day he played me Shining Light, which we were like, that's the one, that's the comeback single that we've been looking for.
Yeah.
Played it to management, they were like, yeah. Played it to producer, yeah, that's the one. Played it to record company, that's not the one.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, because you know, it was probably a pretty dodgy demo or whatever, but they just couldn't hear it. So we decided to sort of like, no, this is it. And we paid for the studio ourselves. And Owen kind of waived his fee. And we were like, we're recording it anyway. And like finished it, delivered it to them. And they were like, yeah, okay, fair enough, you were right. But yeah, at that point, we were just like, we were like about a month away. And then we sort of recorded, like, so they paid the advance. And we finished the rest of that album.
Right.
As well, but yeah, that was a
touch and go,
big roll of the dice.
And I suppose because you guys have worked with a lot of different labels over the years as well, how's that relationship been? Has it been, because you know you see bands like the Stone Roses end up in litigation for like what, 2 years or two, you know, that kind of thing. Is how's that worked out for you?
We've been alright. I mean, it's there's someone sitting across the other side of the room from us that, she was actually with Court of Marshall. They started Infectious and were running it out of Court his back bedroom. He'd been at, I think it was Chrysalis.
Okay.
Maybe he was MD and he'd been sacked with that. Took Pop Lead Itself with him, and then they did Number One and then signed us. So we were like the first band he'd like signed from scratch, running it out of his back bedroom, and she's still working with us to this day. So it's that's pretty amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
But you know, I think you know, our like the most success we had was when it was like very much an independent thing, you know, and there was a lot more flexibility for deadlines and just things we just sort of get done. Like, we've always struggled a bit more when it's been part of a bigger machine, you know, being more of that corporate kind of side. So
because I'm always interested to see how bands transition from, I suppose, the pre-internet where you're like selling records, and now it's all downloads, and obviously with Spotify, and you know, there's kind of less money coming in. You know, even in Ireland now, that rap, that money seems to be getting smaller and smaller, and the companies in the UK are trying to keep that money, and it's going to get to a point where, like for me as a session guy, if I play in a record and a record does well or it gets lots of radio play, I'm not gonna get paid.
Yeah.
And where does that leave you then? It's because in a lot of situations you're helping songwriters out, you're helping people out going in the studio, and there isn't a lot of money floating around these days.
Yeah.
So by trying to get on records, you're hoping that might bring in some income, or you'll get some tours out of it. You know.
Yeah.
So I mean, how did that change for the band as well?
Yeah. I mean, I guess you know, in sort of like mid to late 90s when we were lucky enough to be around at that point where there was a bit of money, but you know, it's like, I guess, you know, we didn't probably have quite an extravagant crew or whatever.
Yeah.
These days we've got a very slimline crew, you know, there's no excess in the road because we know that's where you got to make the money. So
yeah, it's kind of I mean, how many people would you have on the road in terms of techs? And
usually about three. I have a tour manager, sound engineer, and one backline. That's it.
And one guy. Well, I suppose with three people as well, is like, you don't need.
I kind of like setting up my own stuff anyway.
I've always been the same.
Yeah.
Now, don't get me wrong. The gig's over, and I'm gagging for a beer. Someone can take it down. I'll set it up, but can someone take it and load it into the van? Yeah, I've always been the same.
I think over the years I got more particular as well. It's like, I know some people would sit down behind a kit and be like, you know, don't have to move a single thing. I'm like, I set it up myself and I'm still not happy. I'm like, oh, I just need to move that hi-hat a couple of inches.
It's like an OCD kind of thing going on with drummers, you know. I'm the same. Everything has to be at the right height, or it's just going to ruin my gig, you know.
Yeah, I'm trying to make a conscious effort to not be that guy on this tour.
Yeah.
Just be a bit more relaxed about it.
And come here, you've had a lot of songs on movie. What I read this morning was Kung Fu, was it in Rumble in the Bronx?
It was, yeah.
And you had a song in a Jackie Chan movie. That's,
I know, we go
fucking cool.
We get made honorary members of the Jackie Chan fan club as well.
Did you really?
We did. There was like, after that, we really tried to get him on stage with us to do like Kung Fu Kicks on the breakdown, which has never happened.
Oh, really?
No.
Oh,
yeah,
that's a shame.
There was one point where he was in the UK. He was around Reading Festival. Where he was in the UK. We were like desperately trying to get him down, but no dice.
That's a pity. That's a pity. Because you did some music for a Star Wars game.
Yeah, it was like Republic Commando, which was like I think 2004 or 2005, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was, I think it was the first time anything sort of like Star Wars related had used music from outside of the John Williams world as well. So we got to go to like Skywalker Ranch.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah, that was pretty amazing.
That's cool. Buddy of mine
got the Indiana Jones. I've still got my Skywalker Ranch coffee cup.
That's so cool.
Well. Yeah,
that's
pretty amazing.
That's amazing. Yeah, a buddy of mine worked out there for a while, and I think he got to be like a stormtrooper in the special edition.
Yeah,
you know, and they added some CGI stuff into it. You've got to have like, you must have had a few pinch me moments over the last few years. I mean,
yeah.
Is there any examples of a time when you're like, holy shit, I can't believe my luck, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think, well, having the album's gone to number one. It's like just, I mean, from where we started out, you know, it was like very much this DIY indie ethic. And then to suddenly have, you know, the number one album, it's just like, it was just weird. It was a kind of like, as everything sort of built up to that, it was like kind of going that way, but it was never, like for me anyway, it was never like a, right, we released an album, it's going to be number one in the charts. You know, that was pretty surreal.
Yeah, I can only imagine. You know. Yeah, a buddy of mine, Rory Doyle, he plays with Hozier. His last record went to number one in America. So it's great. It's great when you see an Irish drummer who's playing on number one record. Yeah. You know what I mean? Anywhere, if it's in the UK or, you know, it's a massive achievement. It really, really is. And there was another, A Life Less Ordinary as well. That was,
yeah.
Was that specifically written for the film?
It was. Yeah, yeah. It was. It was weird. Danny Boyle got in touch and he said he'd used some Ash stuff sort of to cut footage, I think, in Trainspotting. It never didn't sort of quite fit the soundtrack, but he said he really enjoyed sort of like editing his stuff together using our tracks, and he wanted us to do the song for the soundtrack. There's a couple of versions of it kicking around.
Right.
We did a version with Tim Simonon as well, which is really, it was really raw. But I think it's bits of it used in the movie, because we did the song, but then we had his edited footage like shown in the studio that we were like playing to,
right,
as well. So that was quite a trip. We'd never done anything like that. It was just trying to, you know, get things to work with the cuts of the films and arrange the music around that and play it live as well. That was
far out.
Pretty weird thing to do, but yeah it's kind of.
It's working with film. It's a totally different thing, isn't it? You know.
Yeah.
So you were actually working with Danny Boyle.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't in the studio while we were doing it. But okay. We were just kind of recording, arranging the song to order to this scene in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was pretty nuts.
That's wild, because I worked on a movie called Frank with Michael Fassbender. Do you know?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Lenny Abrahamson. It's a difficult surname to say that. Lenny's great, and himself and Steve Renix. There was me and a bunch of guys were like this kind of house pre-production band, and you know, you've seen the movie, so it's all very avant-garde music. So, you know, a director will come in and you've no chords or anything, and you just describe the scene and go, right, let's just start playing. And you know, the writer, Steve Renix, you know, he was going, right, speed up there, play crapper. You know, he's like you're playing too good, play like you're crap. You know, and it was a great experience, you know. I mean, it would have been great. I know one of the lads got to kind of work on the film, but it was just great to work with those two guys for like a week.
Yeah.
And Donald Gleeson came in and did a bit of work with us and stuff. And that was a very, very interesting project, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, are you guys just going to keep going until you keel over? Is that the plan?
Can't really think of anything better to do, to be honest.
Yeah. But is there still an enthusiasm for it? You know, I mean, there's still an audience for you. There's still an audience out there. I mean, is your audience grown? Or have you managed to kind of get in with a younger audience as well? Because, I mean, I would have been your audience 25 years ago.
Yeah,
you know?
I don't know how many of the younger kids we're reaching these days. But, you know, you get the few that turn up as well, and it's kind of weird when you see like people our age with their kids down the front, and they're both singing all the words to Girl From Mars. Like, that's just like a so weird.
That's gas. Yeah. I was chatting to Adam Marcello, and like he's Katy Perry's MD, you know, and drummer, and he's a real cool guy. He lives in Dublin. And you know, he was saying, like, because the Katy Perry show is massive production, dancers, it's like a circus, you know, there's fireworks going off and all this kind of stuff. And he says, you know, he'll be jamming away with the band at the back, and you look down and it's all these young girls there, you know what I mean? But there'll always be like one dad in a Metallica t-shirt going, "Yep, I see you, man." You know what I mean? Yeah. He's just like totally checking out
that's
the band. So yeah, I mean, from a playing point of view, I certainly, there's nothing worse when you see a really good drummer or somebody who packs it in for whatever reason, you know. But I mean, can you see yourselves going making new records?
Yeah, I mean, we've already got a new record. It's like I finished recording the drums. I think it was like a year ago in August.
Right. Okay.
So it's I'm done. Like Tim's doesn't like to get things finished too up front, but it's just with this sort of best of thing, it's kind of put the brakes in that. So kind of like he's still got like lyrics to finish and he's got to sing it, but yeah, I mean, that's as far as I'm concerned, it's ready to go, just needs mixing. So yeah, we're kind of like sitting in that. Just really want to get that out as soon as this is over. So
and how do you guys work? Does Tim send you a demo, and or do you actually just get into a room and just start jamming it out?
Yeah, I mean, Tim will he's using this weird method at the minute, which he's been using for the last couple of years, but he'll just like do a song challenge where he gets a couple of like songwriter mates, and they all go, right, they pick a day where they're all free, and they'll separately do a song challenge thing. They try and write 10 songs in a day.
Right. And that's then a great idea.
And then they get together, play the stuff to each other, and then just go on the rip. Have a blowout after it. So
that sounds great.
Great. It's just the amount of material. He's been doing that for like 4 years, maybe longer. But he's obviously amassed a ridiculous amount. I was like, so when I think I'm finished a record, he'll be like, "Oh yeah, I've not sung those songs yet. I've done a few more song challenges. I should come over to the studio and work in another 10 songs."
Right, okay. And would you just, is that what would happen then? Is it, would you kind of work with him, get some drum tracks down, and then they'd build around that? Yeah. Or?
Well, they wouldn't, like the song challenge thing is basically just getting like a verse and a chorus done.
Yeah.
So it'll be still be quite, you know, we have a good idea of like sort of melody and a few like key hooks and stuff like that. So we, at that point, then we all get together in the studio and sort of like knock it into a proper kind of arrangement.
Okay.
Or whatever. So, and then from that point, he's got like song structure to go, okay, I've got like, you know, 2, 3 or whatever verses to write.
Okay, okay.
And finish.
So very much then you get the demos, go into the studio. There wouldn't be like 3 or 4 weeks of like production rehearsals or anything like that.
No. I think we tend to like work is the stuff that we get into the room and sort of take from his demo into sort of like it becomes an Ash song at that point, and we're all like excited about it. We're just like, right, let's get it done. Yeah,
because every band has their own way of working. I mean, I know with Pro Tools, like, you know, in the last few years, I've done some records where, you know, you might just have a click track and a vocal and an acoustic guitar, and that kind of has its limitations because you're not really bouncing off anybody, you know. The record I did with John Parrish actually was just, you know, I was going into work with some people I'd never met before. It was new experience. I wasn't nervous about it, but I just was hungry to do really well. You know, when you go into a situation that you want to, first of all, do a good job.
Yeah.
You know, and you want to impress people. You want them to, you know, just to think this guy's good, or, you know, he's got good ideas.
Yeah.
So myself and John Murray, the singer, he's a weird way of working. It's just, he has all these fragmented ideas. After about 2 hours, just, we have a song.
Right.
And I mean, you know, within 4 days, we got most of the record done. And I think it's turned out great, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, you see people like Taylor Hawkins and Dave Grohl. I mean, when they record, it's just the two of them, isn't it? They just get a drum track down with a vocal and guitar, and then the guys all come in and do their thing around it.
Yeah.
Which I think is an interesting way of working.
Yeah, I mean, we've done a lot of that as well. You know, it's like once we get the arrangement, it's like sometimes Tim will just put down a guide or whatever. Like sometimes, like if Mark's busy, it's like, oh, fine, I'll just play the guitar. Just kind of like all over the place. It's just like we vaguely get the arrangement, say, turn the guitar down a bit.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. And I was looking as well. Did you guys tour with the Pumpkins, or did you just do?
We've done a few shows with them over the years, festivals and stuff. We did. I think the last one we did was it must be close to 10 years ago now, at Wembley. We supported them as well, which was pretty amazing.
Was that when they did the kind of comeback album?
Yeah,
I think it would have been the comeback record. Jimmy was on drums, was he?
No, he wasn't.
Oh,
actually,
was he not?
This was before that.
Oh, was this the young guy they had? He was like 21 years of age, and he was just like
I didn't get to meet him. I'm not sure, but yeah. So,
have you ever got to meet Jimmy over the years at all?
Well, we played with him in Dublin at the SFX back. This was a couple of weeks before Jimmy was kicked out of the band.
Right. Okay.
And obviously, we were quite young at the time as well, so they'd sort of finished sound check and whatever. And I think I did just get up and sit behind his kit.
Yeah, yeah.
Just like, wow.
It's mad, because I was playing a show with Marianne Faithfull in Chicago, and I walked into the dressing room and Olive Zwan were there, so I got to play with Billy Corgan that night. He was on stage.
Amazing.
Playing, because we did Letterman 2 days before and he was supposed to come and do the show, but because it was September 10th 2002, it was September 11th obviously, it was the first anniversary. Uh-huh. So no one was flying anywhere, nobody wanted to fly, so he didn't come. But we went to Chicago, and I think it was the 12th of September we played. But I remember walking in the dressing room and like seeing Jimmy there, and like, you know, you just get your fanboy, you're just trying to be cool.
Yeah,
you know. And Joe Perry from Aerosmith was there. I know I'm all name dropping here, but I had to play a gig with Jimmy Chamberlain sitting in the front row, and you know, and he was super nice and gave me his email. And you know, he recommended like the George Lawrence Stone book to me, Stick Control. And,
oh yeah.
And then coincidentally, I met him several times and over the years of festivals, you know. I've had him over in the college in BIM. He actually came over like last year or the year before, because Anne Marie Shields, our mutual friend, would know him quite well. And we had him over, and he just rocked in and played a load of Pumpkins tracks, you know. And just to be right up front with him, I mean, he's as good as, if not better, than he ever was, you know. I mean, so in terms of drummers, who were you listening to when you were younger? Who were the guys that really kind of...
Well, you mentioned Joe Perry. I mean, it was around the time I got into drums, I was a massive Aerosmith fan.
Yeah.
So he was like probably like early days, like first sort of like drummer I was like kind of really got into. And then obviously like with the Nirvana thing, like Dave Grohl was like a totally different beast.
Yeah.
To that, and that was that was a big thing as well. But I don't know much it sort of took from them in the early days. It took a long while for me to figure out how to get that par, I think. Not saying that I got his par now, but it was like kind of like do my own version of it or whatever. But
sure.
Yeah, well, he's definitely big influence. And then from that, like John Bonham and stuff. But yeah, you know, I've gone. Yeah, I can geek out the jazz stuff without necessarily understanding what the hell's going on as well. But going through, like, you know, listen to Buddy Rich stuff. And
yeah, I love all that. I never aspired to play it, though. I just enjoy listening to it.
Yeah.
You know, I went to see Nate Smith, though. I saw him in New York a couple of years ago, and I was able to actually, there was seats behind the kit. So he just released his album, Kinfolk, and that guy is... I just do not know how he plays those right-handed 16s as fast as he does.
Yeah.
You know, he's outrageous. Just, you know, he's like a turbocharged Steve Jordan, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that, if you think of, I was talking to Graham about this in the 90s, you know, you had your Chili Peppers and your Alice in Chains and Jane's Addiction and Primus and Fishbone. Living, there were so many great bands, you know, and with so many like great drummers in them as well. I just thought it was a great time to be, you know. And Nirvana, obviously, when they exploded, all these other bands exploded.
Yeah,
you know. And even at that stage, this is when guys were like still making cassettes for each other.
Yeah,
like, you
exactly.
know, ripping cassettes. Yeah. And have you heard this? And you know, it was a great time in music, you know. Funny you mentioned the SFX. I remember seeing the Chili Peppers there, and that was Blood Sugar Sex Magic just came out, and John Frusciante was just fucked up, like, and you could just see it. It was one of the weirdest gigs I've ever been to.
Yeah, well, Pumpkins were kind of the same at that point. I mean,
really,
this was like, it was less than a month after the overdose, all that stuff happened, and SFX. I mean, they were. I remember watching them going like, "This is insane." it's taken me to the last chorus of this song to recognise what the song is. I mean, I think crew and everything were all...
Was everyone just off their mashed?
Heads. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was...
That's mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, that's, isn't that the trap, isn't it, that we can all fall into?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
You know, I had a last weekend that lasted 2 years where I was about 25 and I just went for it. I just, up to that point, I hadn't really dabbled, smoked a bit of dope, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, but I was touring a lot. And the thing was, we were doing a lot of support tours and stuff. I just remember everyone going, "You guys are so nice. You're such cool guys." I was like, "Yeah, because we're pretty out most of the time."
Yeah, well, I'd say that's the danger of doing the support tours, because your day is compressed into, like, you know, you saw and check, and then you're on stage an hour later, and then you're done.
You're done,
and then you've got all night to play, and all the rest of the next day to recover.
I know. Yeah. It's those support tours are like being on your holidays. I did a lot of arena tours, so it was the Wembleys, and I remember doing like 10 weeks with Meatloaf, going around, and that was a big tour, and they were a nice bunch of people, and really, and you know what, he paid for our catering and all that kind of stuff. But you know, it's funny because I interviewed Dave Brown, who I've been in and out of Picture House with for 30 years, you know, and we'd go on those tours and, you know, we'd make 100 grand, but it'd still cost us 10 grand by the time everyone takes their bit out of the merch and all of that kind of stuff, you know. I mean, I went to see Living Colour a couple of years ago in the Garage in Glasgow, and it's funny because, like, they're a Grammy winning band, they were signed to Sony, they sold a couple of million albums, you know, but the minute the gig was over, straight down the merch stand.
Yeah.
You know, do you guys do that now? Do you kind of mix with the fans and stuff like that?
Yeah, totally, yeah.
It seems to be more the norm, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, ever since, you know, like, sort of mid-2000s, it's like everyone's like, you know, you got to do it.
Yeah.
You know, it's fun, you know.
But do you think, I think with Instagram and stuff like that, a lot of the mystery of fandom has kind of gone, you know, the way you can follow celebrities now, or, you know, I'd be titillated by leaving a comment on, like, Brad Wilkes, you know, page, or Richard E. Grant, the actor, and if they leave a, like, Sheila E. sent me a message one day and I was like, fuck, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, because I posted a Modern Drummer magazine from the 90s that she was on the cover, you know,
and she
was like, that's so awesome. And, you know, it's kind of cool when that stuff happens, but it definitely, it means that the people that you idolise or whatever you're a fan of, they seem to, you've more access to them now.
Yeah.
Do you know what we do?
The mystery's kind of gone.
I think so. Yeah. You know, I mean, there's very, even when you look at movie stars now, there's very few that are actual kind of movie, even the mystery out of their lives, because now the media,
they
just publicise a lot of shit about them constantly, you know?
Yeah.
But how have you found dealing with the fans over the years? Do you
it's, you know, being a drummer now, it's pretty easy because, you know, you've met Tim.
Yeah.
You know how nice Tim is, right?
He's very nice.
Everyone wants to talk to Tim.
Yeah.
So you can sort of like pick and choose who you talk to.
Yeah.
And if you disappear, you know, no one's that bothered.
Yeah. It is a lot easier. Absolutely. Yeah. I've seen it with Glenn Hansard, you know, everybody just wanted a piece of Glenn, you know.
Yeah.
I remember when he won his Oscar, I had people ringing me, "Can you get Glenn to do this?" And I was like, I'm not the direct hotline to Glenn Hansard, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, all of a sudden, you know, getting invited to charity events, and that was weird, just having to kind of...
Yeah, you chat to people for a bit and they're like, "Where's Tim?" And I says, I'll just go and get him. Just go back to the dressing room.
Yeah. My bass player in Pictures, he plays with the Water Boys now, Angus. He used to do great when he'd call me over here. I want you to meet. And as I'm shaking her hand, he'd walk off and he'd just leave me with them. You know?